Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here live from the Kintech Studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at DunbarLumber.com. Canucks are in Vegas. Take on the Golden Knights tonight at 7. We'll have Jesse Granger from The Athletic, who covers the Golden Knights, on at 1. Before that, we can dive into the inbox a little bit here. Snoop the Dog says, would you still pick Nashville over Vegas as a first-round playoff opponent if Vegas wasn't able to activate their LTIR players for Game 1, i.e. no Stone or Hurdle? Well, Hurdle is going to come off before the playoffs start. Latest word out there is that he was skating with the team today. Looks like he's going to play at some point this week, although not tonight for Vegas. But yeah, I mean, the uncertainty around Mark Stone, not just his status, but what form he'll be in if he does play, or how effective he'll be coming back from, what was it, a lacerated spleen? I mean, that's a huge part of the argument to want to play Vegas, right? Is he's such a key player for them, such an incredibly valuable player. Uncertainty around Stone definitely gives me pause, but I think there's still enough upside there with and talent there with Vegas that even if Stone is limited or unable to play, I think I'd pick Nashville. And they'll be healthy other than that, right? This idea that they're going to have so many players coming off LTIR in time for the playoffs. Like, they've already gotten mostly healthy. Hurdle's going to come back. It's really just Stone. And again, Stone's status is very, very much up in the air. It's not as if he's going to be, you know, incredibly well-rested and in great condition necessarily for Game 1 of the playoffs. Another one comes in here. Unsigned. We often talk about which opponents we want to see first round. Flip side, what teams want to see the Canucks first round, do you think? So who's out there licking their chops to play the Canucks? I mean, it's got to be the Kings at this point. With the way they've been able to stifle the Canucks with their 1-3-1, I would think that seems like a pretty compelling matchup to LA right now.
Maybe. I mean, the thing is all of those three games that they've played, and I get that it feels like the Canucks or the Kings sort of have the Canucks number, given, you know, three goals, you know, without factoring an overtime, 3-on-4 overtime goal and a 6-on-5, like, right? Like, if we remove that, three goals for the Canucks in three games, that's not great. But the Kings have scored first in all three of those games.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's not like fate. That's not like something that's just going to happen every time those teams play. No more than it's fate that the Canucks are going to score first in a quarter of their playoff games the way they have in the regular season, you know, often in the first 5 minutes, right? I mean, 20 plus games, first goal in the first 5 minutes. And then the Canucks lock it down and they pick apart mistakes. And guess what the Kings do? They do the exact same thing. To me, we haven't seen the Canucks and Kings play a game in which, like, the break went Vancouver's way first. But I think if we do, we'll see the games look pretty similar to the way that they've looked when they've been frustrating for Vancouver. We'll see
LA struggle to generate.
Because the Canucks find opportunities.
And I think it's a fair point in those games. It's not as if LA has been, like, piling on the offensive chances. They've had to play really strategically and go look for those against the grain chances when they've been able to. But it wasn't, like, dominant puck possession from LA by any stretch.
It's a thin margin between those two teams.
Yeah.
Which is why I don't think, from a Canucks, like, so while I'm downplaying the Kings' threat, right? Because for me, if your suggestion is the Kings have the Canucks' number, I don't think that's right. I think it's just like a pure coin flip matchup because the style these teams play naturally reduces margin for error anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so, you know, like, for me, it's that's a matchup you don't want because the Canucks are probably better, and yet we kind of know it doesn't matter. But I also think the Canucks will be favored if they meet head to head in the playoffs, and should be.
And I think that dynamic, right, where it's going to be kind of a frustrating slog for both teams in all likelihood if they do meet up. You know, I was thinking about this a little bit yesterday, right, because there's been so much talk about, okay, who do they match up well against? Oh, they lost to Dallas. They lost to LA again. They've lost to Colorado. Can they hang with these powerhouse teams in the Western Conference? And, you know, this question kind of ties into it. Like, what do the other, how are the other teams looking at it? And I think you can, you know, if you want to look at, find reasons why it could be tough for the Canucks to get past Vegas or tough for the Canucks to get past LA in the first round, I think you absolutely can. I think there are valid reasons to be concerned about that. But I also, like, I think the thing I believe most is that I don't think the Canucks are going to be an easy out for any team, right? Like, the Canucks, it might be a slog for them to win a series if their 5-on-5 offense doesn't get going. But I think it's going to be a slog for any team to beat them, too, right? So to the question of who wants to play the Canucks in the first round, I think when you have the profile of really, really good defensive team with Thatcher Demko coming back, even if another team is, like, confident about their ability to ultimately triumph, I don't think that's a particularly appetizing first-round matchup to go into for anyone else, right? Like, it's not going to be easy to run up the score and take out the Canucks early in the playoffs, no, I don't think.
The Canucks are good. Like, yeah. the only team in the West, the only team in the West that I'd even consider picking to beat Vancouver in something like 5 or 6, you know? Like, honestly, well, 5 and 4, because you know that's what matters to me. Mm-hmm. There's no one I'd consider beating them in 4. But it's the Avalanche.
Party! It runs on steam!
Steam! No, but the Avs are the only team that I look at and wonder, is that a truth serum matchup for the Canucks?
Mm.
You know, I mean, I think there are other teams that have a higher, like, baseline of true talent.
I was going to say, not even the Oilers.
Not even the Oilers. I just think the lack of depth that Edmonton has kind of plays into Vancouver's hands. And I think Vancouver's competent playing against teams that are going to have 58% of puck possession,
right?
You know, and one thing about the Kings too is, like, the 1-3-1, we've seen teams get frustrated by it in the past, for sure, especially, like, young offensive teams. I don't think the Canucks profile like a team that's going to struggle to adjust to something like that, you know. And I think there's a variety of reasons for it. One, I don't think Rick Tocchet's going to get pantsed like that by a system.
Yeah.
I just don't. I just think he's going to at least find a couple of answers that allow the Canucks to unlock something.
Well, and it's not as if the Canucks are like the New Jersey Devils, where it's like, oh, we're this free-flowing possession rush team, and now all of a sudden that's been taken away from us by the 1-3-1. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, I think that makes it easier to adjust when that's not your identity anyways.
For sure. And I think there's some players on the Canucks, you know, like JT Miller especially, who are particularly smart about how to attack and take advantage of what they're given. So I look at the Canucks and think, I will be pretty stunned if they're stumped by a predictable system over the course of a playoff series. So, you know, but I do think a team like the Avalanche that can hang with them defensively, but also attack with more speed. I mean, we've seen it every time these teams have played.
Yep.
That's been, I wouldn't say lopsided. There have been games where the Canucks have performed well, but I don't feel like those games have really been in doubt. Like, I don't feel like the Canucks have put the Avs under significant duress in any of those matchups. That's the only team for whom I think that's true in the West.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen what they've done to Edmonton early in the year, albeit, but yeah, you're probably right about that. They've had played close, good games against their other teams. Some of the Av games have ended up being close, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, but like, they're 3-1.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like... white knuckle time for the Avs. They've had to play well.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't been able to sleepwalk to wins or anything. It's not like they're in a totally different weight class. But that's a matchup that seemed to be problematic in the three meetings, in a way, like, we've seen the Canucks play Dallas. We've seen the Canucks outplay Dallas. We've seen them beat Dallas decisively, right? We've seen them lose to the Winnipeg Jets relatively decisively. Mm-hmm. We've seen them
beat the Winnipeg Jets decisively. Yeah.
They've beat the Oilers twice in ways that made the Oilers, like, frustrated and lose their minds. But we also saw the Canucks win
by hanging on for dear life.
One of the most lopsided games of the year, frankly. Honestly, like, I think that second game of the year was one of the worst games the Canucks played on form. But was it DeSmith that night, too?
It was DeSmith, yeah.
DeSmith and, you know, the Canucks.
Akito Hirose was in the lineup.
Akito Hirose and honestly, Noah Juulsen was the third pair, too.
Yep.
Because Soucy was out. And I'd say the third pair helped keep the Oilers in the game because there was a lot of penalties that they took. You know, and then Vegas, likewise. We've seen the Canucks beat Vegas. So, and we've never seen them, like, the Predators and the Oilers are sort of almost absent from this in that the Canucks are perfect against both teams. And yet I don't know that we should feel like those were representative of where those teams are at now. That would be how I'd break it down.
Yeah, and that certainly makes the that final matchup against Edmonton loom pretty large. Three-Putt Shane says, hearing the Canucks and locking it down, two things I haven't heard very often in the same sentence. That's their identity, though. And like, I think that's how they're going to win playoff rounds and playoff games, if they're able to do so, is by leaning on that identity. You need to have more than just that. But that's my point about, I don't think any team's going to be particularly excited about playing the Canucks, because they have that extremely, extremely high defensive baseline, which, you know, I think at least gives them a chance in pretty much any matchup, because the games are going to be close. And once you get into those close games, you're into lucky bounce territory, right? Which can work against a team, but yep, can also serve to make series long, serve to give you a chance.
Although remember, lucky bounces can also come in bunches, and mm-hmm, they can come early. You know what I mean? Like, we all think of the lucky bounce in the playoffs as like the puck that deflects off a stick and on, right? But those lucky bounces can also, you know, come in waves. Like, remember that first period against the Ottawa Senators in January? I mean, honestly, go watch. I recently was thinking about it, and I was thinking, man, that first period was so funny. Like
the Senators one? Yeah, it was amazing.
And I went and rewatched it, and it's just like unbelievable stuff, right? Like, triple deflections into the Canucks net. Pew Suter got a goal where it bounced off the end boards and right to him in, mm-hmm, the slot. Like, just howlers. Absolute howlers. And you can have periods like that in like a 5-0 game right off the hop. And this is sort of where, you know, that can happen to you if you're an elite defensive team. We saw it happen to the Canucks in that Minnesota Wild game, where, like, aside from the PK sputtering, I wouldn't even say they played poorly.
Yeah.
It's just, and I wouldn't say DeSmith played poorly.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it's 10 goals against on you, and it's just like, what? What just happened?
Man. Yeah.
No, but you get periods like that.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of one advantage that, you know, like, Toronto goes up 5-1 against Florida. Well, Florida ends up making it a 1-goal game. It's 5-4 late.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the gear that I worry about the Canucks missing. But their defensive play is also at such a level that you could have a game like that and probably still overcome it and probably still, like, hang in the series.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, so that's an important part of this too.
Marty, the Red Texan, are you guys worried that the Oilers handled the team like the Ducks by putting up 8 on the board while the Canucks almost let the Ducks come back in a tight 1-goal game? I'll say no, I'm not particularly worried about that specifically. But then he goes on to say there have been more examples like this. So how easy/hard will it be to turn it up in the playoffs? Perhaps it's time to conclude that this is what they are, a tight checking team that will be in close games with good goaltending and timely scoring. That's Marty, the Red. And yeah,
that's the recipe.
Tight checking team, good goaltending and timely scoring. Like, I think you summed it up pretty well.
That's the recipe.
That's going to be the formula. The big question mark there, I think, also Thatcher Demko's health, is the timely scoring. Mm. You know what I mean? Because that's the thing, I think, that in a short sample seven game playoff series, like, I have no doubt that their defensive form is going to be there. If Thatcher Demko is good to go, he's going to be good. But it's that timely scoring that I think can come and go. So that's the kind of part that concerns me about the formula.
Well, I don't think it's a concern so much. Like, for me, it's not so much about a concern so much as it's about recalibrating our expectations to understand what this team is. You know, like, the Canucks are still the fourth best offensive team in the West. But for a lot of the season, they were one.
Yep.
And they were won by, like, margins.
Yes.
Right?
By a long way.
They had, you know, goal differentials through the first 35 games that we hadn't seen since the 1980s Oilers. Like, we had, you know, all this evidence, and still to this day, they're like 11 goals better on the season, goals for purely, than the Nashville Predators. But I'm telling you right now, they are not as good an offensive team as the Nashville Predators. Like, they don't have as much,
mm-hmm,
they don't generate shots as much, even though you might like the high-end stars on the Canucks roster, in the Canucks lineup, better. You know, I just think it's sort of understanding that while this team's managed spectacular offensive results this year, they don't really profile like an elite offensive team. And certainly since the All-Star break, we've seen them be a pretty pedestrian goal-scoring team. Like, they're not. Now, a lot of that's the power play. Oh, you iron out the power play, and this Canucks team's probably back to being a top 10 at least offensive team in the league. And you can do a lot with a top 10 offense and a high-end defense.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The concern is that for a long time the Canucks now, and like we're talking like 25 game sample here, have been a middling offense. And I think the reality is probably somewhere in between, because I think the like the 5-on-5 goal scoring alone is something like 15th in the league over the last 25 games.
Mm-hmm.
And if you match that with like a top 10 power play or top 7 power play, you're closer to a top 10 overall offense. And I think that's a realistic place for this team to be or get to with the talent on their roster. But you do need to fix the power play to get, as you said last week, and I sent you a text because I enjoyed it so much, to add that extra dimension that they need to their attack.
Yeah, and again, the power play feels like it's the low-hanging fruit to try to do that, right? More so than like drastically changing your 5-on-5 offensive profile at this point in the season. That's tough to do. That's really tough to do. But the power play, not saying it's easy, but we can see the ingredients there to get it back to that level.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, what the Canucks will tell you when you talk about their offense is a lot of it is the way we manage the puck. We are making disciplined situational decisions that, you know, yeah, sure. Do they take some chances off the board? Potentially. But it's worth it because we're limiting what we give up and we're still controlling more overall. That would be their answer. And I think there's truth to that.
Which is true. Because like if you look at like the just like pure shot attempt share since February 1st, they're third in the league at 5-on-5.
Yeah, so it's impressive.
Like, and that's obviously hugely, you know, that the defense is doing the lion's share of the work and propping that number up. But like there's truth to that. And I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with making that tactical decision. Right? Hey, we're going to be a defensive minded team. It's not as if they're super hyper conservative and sitting back and not even trying to get offensive chances. They still forecheck. They still do those things. I think that's exactly right how they describe it. It's just when the power play also falls off, then it starts to feel, you know, a lot more nerve wracking.
Well, I'd add one more piece of skeptic, like one more thing that I'm skeptical about when I hear that, which is that then why, when this team is trailing, are they still a bottom 10 team at generating scoring chances? Like it would be one thing if the way that this team played leading or tied looked one way, but the way that they played when they were trailing changed.
If it was purely tactical, you could theoretically switch up the tactic when you're down two goals, and then you'd see, okay, now they're generating shots at a much higher rate.
When I see them get one shot in 15 minutes against LA in the third period down two at home, I struggle with the idea that this is, you know, a could-be higher-end offensive team if they were only, you know, willing to risk it sometimes two-on-two. Not just dump it in. You know, like that doesn't hold water to me when it doesn't shift as the game state does. So
yeah, that's an interesting point.
It's it's a tough one for me to really figure out beyond my sort of sneaking suspicion that this team's true offensive baseline's probably closer to average than top five in the West. And, you know, I think there's some options, some games where that's going to be something they have to overcome by being just that tight defensively, just that good in goal, or ideally get their power play going to a level where, you know, it can carry a fair bit of the mustard, especially early in playoff series when the whistle still gets blown for this team offensively.
That's going to be so huge. Right. In those early games when, as you said, when there are still a lot of sometimes even more power plays than we see in the regular season,
usually
right? Because the refs are trying to, quote unquote, control the series or whatever, which they completely abandon later in the series. Taking advantage of those opportunities early in a series is going to be vital for this Canucks team.
And likewise, not getting burned. Right.
Yeah.
Because that's, I think, another thing we're talking about or we should be is this team's gone to sort of a more pressure heavy look on the PK and it's looking great. Like power play got itself to average and now on form and on recent results actually looks like
penalty
it has
kill.
A shot to put what did I say?
Power play.
Oh yeah. The penalty kill.
Yeah.
Has looked like even more legitimate or has a shot to be even more legitimate than that. That's the part of the Canucks game that's peaking at the right time in addition to the defensive play.
Johnny Mack texts in speaking about the power play. Dakota Joshua seems like a no-brainer as the net front presence on power play one. I mean, we were talking about lineup wrinkles or tinkering we might see from Tocchet today, and given that there's been this kind of rotating cast of fifth guys on the power play, given the goal that Dakota Joshua scored. And I know you'll point out that the Ducks gave him all sorts of time and space in front of the net, which is
still a sick goal.
It's still a sick goal. And, you know,
I'm not taking anything away from it. You know, I'm here for Dakota Joshua.
It does seem like, let's try it. It's not as if there's, you know, Connor Garland hasn't taken that
while,
run with
though, it. As like a program, right?
Yeah, I mean, you have especially. I've been more, like, I don't have a problem with it, but I've been more bump him up the lineup at 5-on-5.
Yeah. I want the big guy at the net front.
My thing is just if Lindholm is healthy, to me, he should be the fifth guy on the power play. But he's not healthy. So you got to try things. And one of those things should be Dakota Joshua.
Yeah, just pick the big body with good hands.
With really nice hands.
Yep. And you know, wind him up, point him
at the net,
point him to the blue paint, and behind the net whenever there's a retrieval.
Yeah.
And just enjoy.
Let him do his thing.
Yep.
Yeah. I hope we get to see a bit of that tonight when the Canucks take on the Vegas Golden Knights. We will speak to Jesse Granger, who covers Vegas for The Athletic, next. Lots going on. Always lots going on with the Golden Knights as the playoffs near. That's coming up next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
It's Canucks Central with Dan Riccio and Satyar Shah, your destination for everything Canucks. Exclusive interviews, inside info, and even the postgame show. Listen 4 to 6 p.m. weekdays and on demand through your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We are now joined on the phone. He covers the Vegas Golden Knights for The Athletic. He is Jesse Granger. Jesse, thank you very much for doing this. How are you today?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. I'm great. How are you?
We're doing well. Looking forward to this one tonight between the Canucks and the Golden Knights, a potential first-round playoff matchup, although still lots to be decided in terms of matchups and all that in the Western Conference. I mean, we've talked a lot. Like, our show is called Canucks Talk, so obviously we're focused on the Canucks, but we've ended up talking a lot about the Vegas Golden Knights, especially recently, because they've been such a fascinating team, such a difficult team to kind of figure out who are they really. I think their form has started to improve in recent weeks. What are you seeing in terms of that baseline form from the Golden Knights recently here?
Yeah, it's for sure improved lately. They hit a pretty bad stretch there when they had the worst of their injury concerns, and they did play some bad hockey. And what was most concerning, I think, during that stretch was even in the games that they won, they weren't winning them in the way that this team is built to win games and the way that they're used to winning them, which is with its defense and just kind of limiting the other team. They were sort of outscoring their defensive issues. But lately on this last stretch, I think they're 8-2 in their last 10, and they really do look like the team they're supposed to look like. The scoring isn't there still. They aren't executing offensively as well as they need to and as well as they'll have to if they're going to advance in the playoffs. But the defensive game has really shored up there. For a while, I think they were bottom five in the league for a stretch in high danger chances allowed. Lately, they're back up to first or second, depending on the day, on how many high danger chances they're allowing. So this is the type of hockey that they played last season that made them so successful. They aren't quite executing it at their highest level. I don't think that they're playing their best, but they are playing better, and it's been good enough to win some close games lately. They've been playing a lot of low-scoring games. It feels like every night it's either tied 0-0 or 1-0 going into the third period every night, and that's the kind of hockey that Bruce Cassidy likes to play. They obviously have a really good defensive core. They're 8 deep on defense right now. They've been having to healthy scratch 2 really good NHL defensemen pretty much every night. because they're so deep there. So even with Aiden Hill out, the defense has been really, really good. And that's an encouraging sign for Golden Knights fans.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, that slump, especially in terms of defensive underlying numbers and how they've really rebounded. Was it mostly injuries, or was it like Stanley Cup hangover kind of dog days thing? What, in your view, what was causing that slump earlier in the season?
I think injuries have some role in it. I think more so than the actual players being out. I think it was the fact that they had so many guys get hurt and come back into the lineup and out of the lineup, and there wasn't a lot of chemistry. They were very out of sync, and they were, at that time, they were running into teams that are good hockey teams that are in playoff position that are clicking. Like, things are clicking for them, and you're trying to figure out, you're playing with guys on a line you haven't played with, on a pairing you haven't played with, and you're trying to figure things out, and you're playing against teams that are in peak form, that are like ramping up for the playoffs, and they were just getting pressured. I think that their biggest issue during that time was puck management, going through the neutral zone, coming out of their own end. They were really silly turnovers every night. I think when the Golden Knights are set on their defense and they have their good gaps, they're really, really hard to score on. Even during that stretch when they weren't playing well, I don't think the defending itself was the issue. It was turning the puck over and putting yourself into positions where you aren't set defensively. You can't get good gaps because the puck was turned over while you were exiting the blue line, and suddenly you're in a scramble situation, and then the goalies weren't bailing them out. That's the other thing. The Golden Knights had a miraculous run of goaltending last year. Aiden Hill was spectacular in the playoffs. Like, yes, the defense in front of him made his job easy, but he was awesome. And this year, they haven't been bad, but they just, especially for that stretch, the goaltending wasn't bailing them out when they needed it. The goaltending had its dip in play at the wrong time, I think, which led to a lot of losses.
With where Vegas is at injury-wise, I mean, what we know that Tomáš Hertl is getting close. Do we know anything about Aiden Hill? Do we know anything about Mark Stone? Do we know anything about any of the other wounded Golden Knights?
Yeah, like you mentioned, Hertl, he's been on the ice the last 2 days. Today he got rid of the no-contact jersey, so the next step is playing. We asked Bruce Cassidy this morning if he's going to be on the upcoming road trip, and it didn't sound like he was going to play on the road trip at the very least. Cassidy kind of went over the practice schedule and trying to figure out if they want him to come to practice. He didn't confirm it, but it does sound like they're going to wait at least another game or two for Hertl. So, but he is close, like you said. They haven't been giving many updates. Aiden Hill, it is a lower body. It looked like it was the similar injury that he's been dealing with all year. He's had this injury multiple times. Don't know that for sure, but just the way he went off the ice would lead you to believe that maybe that's still lingering. And then Mark Stone, they've kind of ruled him out for the rest of the regular season. There's hope that he can play in the playoffs. He has not been skating, so there's not really any progress in terms of that. It's really weird because it was a lacerated spleen. Like, I don't know how his recovery is going to look, because I think a lot of injuries, even while you can't play hockey, you can't be on the ice, you can at least keep your physical conditioning up. And I think that is going to be a challenge for Stone dealing with this. I think you have to go a long period without any physical activity. Just that's the way I understand it. So maybe it's going to be a little bit longer of a runway just to get back into physical shape before he can even get back on the ice. So my gut tells me he's not going to be ready right when the playoffs start, but if you would have asked me that last year at this time, I probably would have said the same thing, and he was ready. So we'll see what happens with Mark Stone. It's pretty up in the air. The only one that's really close that we have a good idea that's coming back soon is Hertl.
Yeah, and on that point about Mark Stone, you know, I'm sure you're well aware of the reaction around the league, right, with, oh, he's going to be back for game one, and they're doing it again. But as you pointed out, like, this is not, it's not as if he's skating and just kind of slowly biding his time, ready to get back on the ice for game one of the playoffs. And even beyond that, I think there's a massive question about what shape he's going to be in, how much he's going to be able to contribute on the ice when he does return. And just, look, we all know Mark Stone's a phenomenal player, captain of the team, obviously, but how much of a blow is it to the Golden Knights if, one, he's not there for the start of the playoffs, but even if he is in kind of a reduced capacity?
I think it's everything. I remember saying this last year, that if the Golden Knights don't have Mark Stone at his best, they cannot win the Stanley Cup. And he came back for game one of the playoffs. The first two games were pretty rough. And at that point, they were struggling against Winnipeg. They lost the first game. They almost lost the second game. They went up to Winnipeg for game three and almost lost that one. They went to double overtime, and Michael Amadio scored. And they did not look like a team that was prepared for a long playoff run. Then all of a sudden, Mark Stone starts to look himself. and they're a freight train, and they ran through everyone and won it all. I still feel the same way. If the Golden Knights don't have Mark Stone at his best, they're a totally different team. I think not just how good Mark Stone is, like just his individual skills. He's obviously great, and the way he plays hockey, the way he thinks the game makes everyone else better on the ice. But I think even aside from that, he's the captain. He's the emotional leader. We all see how ridiculous he acts when he scores goals. It's awesome. It's contagious for everyone else. I really do think he is the engine that makes this team run. And if he comes back, if he's able to come back and he's able to look like himself, I think this is a team that nobody wants to play in the playoffs. But if not, if they don't have Mark Stone at close to his best, I think it's going to be very tough. Even, I mean, this is still a good team. Don't get me wrong. They're a tough out, but they are not the same team without Mark Stone.
How do you look at the Canucks and how they stack up relative to the rest of the Pacific Division from your vantage point in Sin City?
Yeah, it's for me, Canuck, like as an outsider, the Canucks are super interesting because they've had the scoring talent and the goaltending for a couple years now. To me, Tocchet getting them to buy in and play the team defense, they're not allowing anything. And like Demko hasn't been in, and I thought maybe that would lead to a bunch of goals against, and they're not allowing any. DeSmith deserves some credit for playing well, but I think this team defense, it's a different Canucks team than we're used to. And the Golden Knights have historically had a really good record against Vancouver, and they've kind of pushed them around in those games. Like that, to me, that was the dynamic that I felt prior to this season was Vegas is the bigger, stronger, better structured team. And when they played the Canucks, that showed. This year, that hasn't been the case. I think the Canucks are more physical. I think they pressure more on the forecheck. They play better defense. They have better structure. And then they've got the elite shooting talent that they've always had. And when Demko's healthy, he's as good as any goalie in the league. So it's a very different team. And I think in past years, this is a match, like say Vegas and Vancouver end up playing. I think in past years, that would have been a matchup that Vegas invites. Like, yes, all playoff matchups are going to be tough, but that's a team that we match up really well against stylistically. And I don't necessarily think that's the case anymore. These next two games, obviously we're going to get to see these two teams play twice in a week. Maybe that'll change my opinion, but I think that the Canucks are a lot tougher matchup than they had been in the past.
I always like to, on the fly, ask our guests to make tiers, lists of tiers, usually focused on the Pacific Division. Let's just ignore the four Pacific Division teams that won't make the playoffs. Sorry, Seattle, Calgary, Anaheim. I'm not sorry to San Jose. But of the four Pacific Division teams that we expect to see play after Game 82, how would you rank those four in terms of their quality as a team and their Stanley Cup chances?
And that's difficult. Right? If you tell me, I mean, it's difficult on its own. And then you add in the Demko question, the Mark Stone question. Mm. If Mark Stone and Thatcher Demko are both good to go, playing well in the playoffs, healthy, ready to play, I would put Vegas first. That's with a healthy Mark Stone, just because this team has proven they can do it. They've been to the conference finals. It seems like every season. I think it's five times or four times out of six. But they've proven they can win the playoffs. So I'd put Vegas first. I'd put Vancouver second, just because I think the Oilers don't have the goaltending that the Canucks have and I'm a goalie guy, so I'm always going to lean on the goaltending when I think things are close. I love Thatcher Demko. I think his way of playing goalie is so technically proficient. He makes things look so easy. I just love everything about Thatcher Demko. I think he's the goalie I'd want back there. So I'll give the Canucks second. I think the Oilers are third, but I think they can absolutely beat Vegas or Vancouver. And then to me, the Kings, like if I'm putting them in tiers, I think the Kings are a tier below those other three. I think you could order the other three however you want. To me, the Kings are a little below. They're a very good team. And if you fall behind the Kings, you're in trouble because that 1-3-1 trap is a nightmare. And when they get a lead, they can just sit back and not allow anything. But I do think that their goaltending is a question mark, as well as Talbot has played for stretches. I think that's more so just the product of the defense in front of him. So that's how I'd rank them.
So I agree with you. The Kings, to me, are the only team in that mix where I wouldn't be shocked if they beat any of the other three teams, right? So it's not like a big gap between the other three and right. LA, but I would be surprised if LA won 16 games in the Stanley Cup playoffs in a way that I wouldn't for the other three. Does that make sense? You see it that way?
Yep, totally agree. Yep.
Speaking of goaltending, you're mentioning Thatcher Demko and you know how much you like what he can do in the crease, and you know we all saw what Aiden Hill did for the Golden Knights last spring and how sensational he was. Been out of the lineup with injury, but just even other than the injuries, what's his form been like this season for Vegas?
Yeah, he's been very up and down because prior to the injury, he was leading the NHL in save percentage. So he was playing very well, and he just looked very confident. Since coming back, he hasn't been moving as well. It is a lower body injury, so it makes sense that maybe he's not quite as sharp on his edges as he was prior to the injury. But even coming back from the injury the first couple games back, he looked really good, and then it just went downhill. And I think what happened was, goaltending is so, confidence is so important. You have to not only be confident in yourself, but in the defense in front of you, and trust that they've got that pass across so you can go out and challenge that shot. And if you start having second thoughts about whether or not the defense is going to work and do their jobs, you start maybe letting some goals in that you wouldn't normally. I think John Gibson's a great example. You see that guy, like when you play behind a sieve of a defense, eventually you don't just allow goals because they're impossible to stop, but you yourself start playing worse because you're so worried about trying to stop everything and not trusting the defense to do what it's supposed to. And I think that happened a little bit with Hill. When Vegas was struggling, when they returned the puck over a lot, I think he lost some confidence and that hurt him. But Thompson has played, speaking of that, Thompson has played great this last little stretch here, and I think confidence is a big part of it. I was talking to him yesterday, and it's interesting because I think when we hear a goalie that's playing confident, we think of a goalie that plays maybe a little further out in his crease is more confident to challenge shots. And when you get less confidence, you sort of shrink and you shrivel back into your crease and you kind of just hope the puck hits you. But I was talking to Thompson, and he actually said it's the opposite for him. When he's confident, he feels a little more comfortable playing deeper in his crease because he believes in himself to make the saves, whereas when he's not as confident, he maybe – it's a safety blanket for him to just get way out there and cut the angle off and hope it hits him. And he thinks that he's been playing a little deeper. That's allowed him to get over for passes a little faster, and that's led to better goaltending. He's playing – about as well as I've ever seen him play these last couple weeks.
So is there any question about, you know, if they're both healthy, who's getting the start in the playoffs?
That is a great question. It'll have a lot to do with how Thompson plays the rest of the season, because the Golden Knights, they have shown a commitment to Hill this season. They gave him that $4.9 million contract in the offseason, and Cassidy has given Hill every chance this season to prove that he's the guy, to be the number one guy. There was a point right before Hill's re-injury here lately that Hill wasn't playing very well, and Thompson was playing better, and Cassidy still kept going back to Aiden Hill to allow him to play his way to that number one role, and Hill didn't do it. So I think now this is Logan Thompson's chance, and we saw it last year. Laurent Brossoit wasn't the number one goalie all year long, but then at the end of the season, there were a couple, Thompson and Hill got banged up. Brossoit played really well, and they gave him the net going into the playoffs. And if not for an injury against Edmonton, he would have been the goalie throughout the playoffs. So I think with these goalies, this team has shown that they are willing to play the hot hand. And if Logan Thompson continues to play the way he has the last couple weeks through the rest of the regular season, I think I would expect him to be in net for the playoffs.
Jesse, really appreciate it. Should be a good one tonight, and I'm sure we'll chat again if these teams do end up playing each other in the playoffs. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, should be fun. Thanks for having me, guys.
That is Jesse Granger from The Athletic getting us up to date on the Vegas Golden Knights, and I mean, that would be so Vegas, right? Aiden Hill comes out of nowhere, wins the Stanley Cup for them last year, gets the contract, as Jesse was saying there, and then if they just... Yeah, no, we're going to lose Logan Thompson this time. That would be so Vegas.
Well, I also think it probably relates to health, right?
Yes.
Like, you might prefer Aiden Hill 100% over Logan Thompson.
But is he 100%?
Thompson, but do you prefer him at 90% over Logan Thompson? That's, you know, a different question. Aiden Hill wasn't good in that Canucks 3-1 win.
Nope.
And I thought, like, it was really the 3-1 goal right before the end of the second period, which was off the rebound. Aiden Hill had been serving up a few juicy rebounds all game long, and I was sort of watching it thinking, if this continues, it's going to cost Vegas, and it did right at like the worst moment. Now, 2-1 going into the third period, totally different game. Mm-hmm. Vegas didn't play well enough, I don't think. Like, they couldn't connect play against the Canucks the last times we saw these two teams face one another. Like, Vegas could not move the puck reliably across like 150 feet to even begin to do their, you know, big bully setting up scoring chances thing. That's how the Canucks won that game, and Aiden Hill's rebound control ultimately was a big factor. So, you know, now that we know he got hurt, and we did sort of have an understanding that he'd been battling something all season, but, you know, when a guy's in the lineup, you don't typically give them the injury excuse. So, you know, I now sort of look at that game and wonder, was that the best we've seen? Like, was that real Aiden Hill?
Right.
You know, or was that a sign that, hey, this was maybe a re-injury risk for a guy who's clearly not on his game?
Well, it's was it real Aiden Hill? But then the question that follows from that is, are they going to have real Aiden Hill available to them, right? Like, we don't know what his health status is going to be. And I thought that was a pretty significant vote of confidence from Jesse, who obviously a close Pacific Division observer, putting the Canucks right up there, right behind the Golden Knights in terms of teams he likes to go deep in the playoffs out of the division. And of course, a lot of that based on his respect for Thatcher Demko. And, you know, if Demko is healthy, what he could mean for this Canucks team. But I think it also speaks to what we were getting at, where it's like, I don't think anyone is looking at this Canucks team as, you know, he even said in prior years, probably the Golden Knights would have been like, yeah, sweet, we can take out the Canucks. Yeah. But I think because of that defensive element that Rick Tocchet's brought, I don't think that point of view is very prevalent out there anymore.
I thought he diagnosed what Vancouver's done well exceedingly clearly, despite, you know, his goalie union bias. Goalies are the worst.
Well, he's also, I mean, Jesse would have been covering Vegas for the 2020 bubble too, right?
Oh yeah.
So he got it. He remembers Bubble Demko against Vegas.
Oh yeah.
So that's maybe looming large back there as well.
No,
for
I'm Jesse knows his goalies. But, yeah. You know, goalies love to be like, this team's better than that team because of goaltending. I'm really concerned about Cam Talbot. Okay. Faces like 3 quality chances a game. He's fine.
That's true.
Fine all year.
But it's the it's the combination.
How many Demko Talbot head to heads have we seen? Just one, right? Two.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think just two before the injury.
Yeah.
And like the Canucks had zero edge in net because there's just not enough going on in those games.
The Kings just suck the life out of the game.
It's awesome.
Very fun.
Yeah, see, I love
you
defense.
Love it. You're like, yeah.
I love defense, yeah.
Well, I don't have a problem
that's
with
my bias.
I like the Canucks way of playing defense. Like, I don't think it's the Canucks are a really good defensive team, but I don't think they suck the life out of a game the way the Kings do. Like, I think the Canucks are more enjoyable to watch than the Kings are.
Well, no question.
You know what I mean?
Sorry, no question.
I don't have
at
a
least
problem.
The Canucks send guys after
exactly,
the puck.
Exactly.
But, no question. But the Canucks also attack off point shots.
Sure.
At like an insanely high rate.
Sure.
And, you know, I don't love rooting for deflections. Like, aesthetically, I think Canucks fans get really down when they see the Kings' style of play.
Mm.
Like Mark Spector level down. Spec hates the 1-3-1.
Down really bad.
Man, he hates the 1-3-1. But like the Canucks are part of it.
Spec's moved on to goaltender interference reviews. That's his new new punching bag.
So again, I disagree with our good pal. Goalie interference reviews are the one thing, the one type of NHL review that I always feel like I have a good handle on.
That makes sense.
Yeah, because it's about the player's location vis-a-vis the blue paint when contact is made with the goaltender. That's it. Don't judge it off anything but the radar plot of when contact is made with the goaltender, is the player in the blue crease? And if they are, it's coming back. And if they're not, it's not.
It's probably not.
And it's not really about severity.
Yeah, which is the thing that always trips people up, I think, right?
It's like the one that's further out looks way worse.
Yeah.
And yet it stands because the skater's in their own space. Anyway, I actually, I hate reviews generally though. One thing where Spec and I align is like, I dislike.
The offside reviews are brutal.
Yeah, you know, although they've made them so much rarer.
By enforcing the penalty.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's at least we're not seeing coaches just like hopefully challenge.
Yes. That was awful. Awful.
But in general, I can't. The worst part about offside reviews for me is when you have a close entry at the line and it's like a crucial point in the game or in the playoffs. You know what I mean?
Mm.
And I'm just watching it bracing, not bracing for something like interesting to happen, but bracing for something interesting to happen that then comes off the board.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just like, it ruins.
It prevents you from being in the moment and celebrating.
Yeah.
Because you're like, oh, they're going to challenge that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Like, I don't even know.
If it's how I react now whenever a player in the NFL scores a touchdown, but like they were being tackled as they go into the end zone. And you're like, they're going to review that to see if he was down.
Yeah.
And like 95% of the time, it's like, oh, he was down on the one.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's totally. Like, so I'm not really going to get excited yet because he was probably down on the one.
As a big time sports gambler and fantasy guy, I'm often just like, yeah, Gus Edwards is going to get it. David Montgomery. It's David Montgomery time. Jalen Hurts, baby.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're like, yeah, I have Jalen Hurts down on the one. Woo!
Yeah, you're down on the one, DeAndre Swift.
Nothing better than that for us Jalen Hurts managers. That's why fantasy makes everything so exciting.
That's why fantasy, it's true. It really is true.
Even getting a touchback or touchdown called back. It's like, yeah, that's great for me. All right. Man. Final segment of the show coming up here. We'll hear from head coach Rick Tocchet on a game day going up against the Vegas Golden Knights. You can get your text in as well. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Final segment of the show coming up here. Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on the People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz here. We are live from the Kintech studio. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at dunbarlumber.com. All right, it is a Canucks game day. They take on the Vegas Golden Knights at 7 in Vegas. Potential first round playoff preview on the ice tonight. Here is Rick Tocchet speaking to the media down in Vegas earlier today.
Rick, I wanted to ask you, yesterday you said that it's your job to instill the confidence in the guys to elevate their own game here. I wonder, how do you do that? What are some of the ways that you can do that, whether it's on the ice or off the ice?
Well, I think it's obviously watching video individually with a guy, having meetings with the guys, asking their opinions. I think you got to empower certain guys. And when guys are struggling, you know, give them a few tips. I don't think you want to give them too much. I think when guys struggle and you give them too much instruction, I always felt the guys gets a little bit more tighter. So, you know, we have some guys who are having trouble scoring goals. For me, it's just get to the, keep finding those spots, keep going there. Eventually it's going to go your way. That's just the way you come out of slumps.
Brock said to me that a lot of what you guys need to do here in the final games is about mindset. Do you agree with that? Do you think that this is a team that knows what they're capable of and it's about locking in?
Yeah, at this time, the intensity and all that stuff come into play, but mindsets, you know, you have to have a strong mindset. Like I said before, structure, the guys have been doing a good job. It's really the changes or the turnovers, it's the miscellaneous stuff that we've been struggling with, and that's a mindset thing. You know, making sure that you change properly, if there's been guys on the ice for a minute, you have the puck at center ice. The puck has to go deep. You know what? It just happened too much the last few games where we didn't get a puck deep. Then all of a sudden we have to defend. Guys are tired. Or we've had a couple of bad changes where actually it cost us a goal. And that last game, they got two grade A's off of a couple of bad changes. So for me, that's a mindset thing that we got to improve on.
Do you sense the urgency building within the room just naturally?
Yeah, I think so. I think, when you start looking at the season, there's only how many games left, who you're playing, you know, people jockeying for position, who's going to make the playoffs. I mean, and, you know, the fans are excited about us making the playoffs. There's a lot going in it, and I think it's important as a group we handle pressure together, you know, as individuals.
Probably the way the season has gone, it's been a while since you actually worried about making the playoffs, but now that you've clinched, does it make it easier to handle these last games as a team, or do you worry that maybe they lose some urgency because officially they're in?
No, I don't think you lose urgency. I think everybody knows, you know, I think a lot of guys here want to start to play better. There's guys here that there's more to their game. So I think that intensifies. You just want, it's got to have a happy balance. You know, we can't put pressure on guys where they're squeezing their sticks, but they also have to understand that there is urgency. So how do you, you know, experienced guys know how to handle the pressure, and when they're not playing well, how to handle that. And I think that's where, you know, you can really learn from a group setting, or the coaches can help them. You know, we have a lot of guys that play in the playoffs as a coach and stuff. You know, we got to relax these guys so when they go into the fire that they're ready for it.
Among individual priorities, how high would getting PD going be on that list?
Yeah. You know, it's my job to figure ways to get him going. I mean, you know, I thought he was better in the third period. You know, when he's moving his feet, I know everybody talks about it, but when he moves his feet you know, he drives play. He's a hell of a hockey player. So I think we just got to keep reminding him to get in those situations, to move your feet and attack mentality.
He's had Hoglander as a winger who's, you know, very direct, kind of play-driving type player. You had him with Garland when Garland was, Garland is one of the top play drivers too. Now you've got him with Brock. Is there much more you can do as far as changing line mates or partners to get him going, or at some point is it just up to him to?
Well, I mean, you always change lines to try certain people, but, you know, he's got a guy that, you know, he's got Hoglander, he's got, 22 goals, and what's Besser got, 37, 38? I mean, there's 60 goals on the wings. So it's really about that line knowing that if they do the right things, it could be a really dangerous line for us. Because I always want to keep Dakota and obviously, and Gars, when they're together, a lot of good things happen. So, but you know, they might change sometimes, and I think you can't really worry about it. You know, I think you just got to, you know, drive play yourself, and you know, you'll have enough help on the wings.
Have you thought about putting him with Garland and Joshua, PD?
Who's that?
PD.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't really matter. I mean, to me, it could happen down the road. I mean, I'm not sure line combinations. You know, to me, I'm a pair guy, but that's why I think Garland and Josh have to stay together, whoever their centerman is.
Casey.
Yeah, Casey.
Z's getting back in.
Yeah, Z's in. Yeah, the same forwards.
That is Rick Tocchet speaking to the media, just some lineup confirmation stuff. Doesn't say who's coming out on the blue line, but Zadorov's back in. Same forwards, Casey DeSmith start. Some interesting thoughts, though, about the lineup in general, and Elias Pettersson as well from Rick Tocchet there. And, you know, just towards the end saying he focuses more on pairs of players rather than trios or line combinations. And it's really interesting. You know, we so often think of it as a center and a winger as the pair, but to hear him really emphasize Garland and Joshua are a pair. They have to play together regardless of who their center is. I don't think that's a surprise given what we've seen from them all year, but interesting to see that kind of just directly stated, explicitly stated by Rick Tocchet there.
Yeah. And I mean, it makes sense.
They've been great together. They've been awesome together.
It makes sense, but I can't quit
Pugh Suter.
Well, I can't quit Pugh Suter, Miller, Besser.
Mm.
Right?
Well, they're like, it's actually not impossible to square those circles, though, right? Like,
it's not.
You know?
It's not. So with Pettersson, then.
Yeah.
And then you're putting Hoglander back on in the bottom six.
Yeah.
Which, I'll be honest with you, the one thing about Hoglander is I feel like his ability to generate is kind of not, he's not at a point where I think he's like benefiting offensively necessarily from playing with elite players, and I don't feel like he's necessarily helping them either.
Mm.
I think he's a guy who will generate, but like we've seen it all season, it's like, you know,
he'll do it in a bottom six role.
Some of his most productive months of the season have been with like Suter and Lafferty.
Yeah.
You know, like you're telling me that I've already used Suter. So Bluger, Hoglander, and Mikheyev, Hoglander's not going to find a way to just like,
yeah,
do some cool stuff here and there. I think he probably will. I guess the problem with the Suter alignment is without Lindholm,
then you're going with Nils Åman
at center,
which
I don't think
they're very reluctant to.
They very clearly don't like that.
Yeah,
but I can't escape, like, no line in the NHL that's played over 150 minutes has as good an expected goals for percentage as Suter, Miller, Besser. The only one in the same stratosphere is Ryan Nugent Hopkins, McDavid Hyman. Okay. Forward lines, the only forward line, other forward line in the entire NHL that has a better shot attempt percentage is like Martin Nuke, Jordan Staal, and Jesper Fast from the Carolina Hurricanes.
Shout out to the Hurricanes.
Yeah, like systems for sure.
Yeah.
And you know, the only other one even close is Andrej Palat, Nico Hischier, Jesper Bratt. That's it. Like no one else. Oh, there's another Hurricanes line and then the Hyman line and the Barkov-Reinhart line. Like that's it. That's it for teams lines significantly over.
Yeah.
60%.
So like some of the absolute best team or lines in hockey.
Yeah. And it's not a huge sample or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're not talking about, you know, more than 150 minutes or whatever, but we're also talking about 14 goals for 3 goals against plus 11 in 173 minutes. Like I can't ignore.
It's fair
that I need to see more. I need to see that line play a lot more together. And I think it's a really easy answer for this team. But I guess Tocchet would disagree because it blows something of a hole in his fourth line forward and fourth line center. Here's though what I'd say. Like if you're uncomfortable with that, and you've got the 7 defensemen, and you like all of them for different reasons, go 11-7.
Yeah.
Go 11-7. You get Juulsen for the PK and to like be a physical guy. You know what I mean? You have ability to rest and rotate your defenders accordingly. Mm-hmm. And one advantage of shortening your bench is you get to double shift a forward on each line. So if we're in a world where you're playing Pettersson with Garland and
Joshua.
Right. So you now can double shift. Like sometimes you're going to have shifts with Suter as your fourth line center.
Yep.
Right, especially if your 2 fourth liners are Lafferty and, you know, in this case, it would be
Podkolzin probably.
Yeah, right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lafferty, Podkolzin. So you can double shift any guy who can play center. Suter, Miller,
yep.
Pettersson, probably.
Blueger. Probably not double shifting Blueger, but you could.
You could, and honestly, you could probably throw Garland out there and have Lafferty take draws here and there.
Mm.
Or Hoglander. Honestly, you could throw Hoglander out there and just have these like energy shifts from a fourth line that's only going to log 6-7 minutes in the playoffs anyway. I'm truly like if Lindholm is out for too much longer and this club goes into the playoffs, I really think Suter on the top line and at least considering going with 11-7, I honestly think is well worth this club's time.
It's an interesting option. And I would even say that it would be worth putting the 11-7 idea to Tocchet just because I don't know. Have we seen 11-7 at any point this year? I don't think we have. It's some coaches will use it as like a... an active tactical decision. Yeah, Cooper mostly, right? Some people will do it only when they're pressed and like somebody's in, like they're short of forward, so they just go 11-7. But it is an interesting, if you only have 11 forwards you feel really confident in and you have 7 defensemen, it makes sense. But I do think
I think the Canucks are probably at that point if they're this reluctant to put Nils Amon in the lineup.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, especially if you're not going to play him at center. If you don't feel confident using him as your fourth line center, what's his role going to be?
Do you think he plays over Baines tonight?
No. Well, Rick Tocchet says same forwards.
Okay.
So he's not getting in over Baines.
So if he's fallen behind Baines on the pecking order.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, the club could have waived him. Like the club could have waived him and Mark Friedman and had the space to like add a $1.5 million player. And we reported like not... We reported in the lead up to the deadline on this program, the club had decided that he was too important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's again, like to me, he's only that important if you can play him at center. Otherwise, he's just another one of the bottom 6 wingers that's kind of churning in and out of your lineup. Right. It doesn't have that separating factor. I think the big takeaway from this conversation and the reluctance to go away from that strength down the middle is just how important it is to get Lindholm back to open up all of these other options that we're talking about, right? So you can go to you can move Pew Suter around the lineup then without feeling like you're devastating your depth at center because, you know, I think Murph even asked Tocchet there, like, could we see Joshua and Garland with Petey at some point? He kind of said, yeah, it might be a possibility down the road, but I think it really only becomes a live possibility if they can replicate that depth at center that they have right now with Pugh Suter still playing down the middle. Some interesting other commentary there from Rick Tocchet on Elias Pettersson specifically, just saying he needs to move his feet, have that attack mentality. Also says it's my job to figure out how to get him going. Notes that he was better in the third period. I mean, I think especially once the game was tied against the Ducks, the whole team was better in that game, but certainly that was the best stretch for Petey and Hoglander and Besser was in that third period once the game was tied up. And then, you know, I thought it was interesting commentary as well from Rick talking about kind of walking the line between emphasizing guys getting ramped up, emphasizing that sense of urgency without kind of overstating the stakes of these games, right? And he said, you know, a lot of guys here want to start to play better, but you can't put pressure on guys. But they also have to understand there's urgency. And he talked about with, you know, more experienced groups, that's something they've been through. That's something they kind of intrinsically know how to manage. We talk about that all the time, right? Veteran teams coasting into the playoffs a little bit because they know how to flip the switch once they get there. As Tocchet said, you know, you can learn from the guys who've been through it. You know, players like Ian Cole, you can learn from the coaches who've been through those playoff wars. But it's going to be interesting to see how Rick Tocchet himself as coach kind of tries to thread that needle, right? Putting the pressure on guys or at least trying to instill that sense of urgency while also recognizing these are kind of tune-up games before we get to the games that really matter in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, tune-up games.
What?
Sounds like exhibition.
But they are.
Yeah, they are.
They are tune-up games. It's like you're they play Arizona twice.
Gonna lose 10-0 with Jet Wu in the lineup. Is that what we're...
That would be concerning.
That's where we're going?
Can you imagine 10-0 loss to Calgary in that game?
I'd honestly see it as a good omen.
Get it out of the way.
Yeah. Well, it worked.
Get the stinker out of
it. It worked in the preseason. If we're tuning up, we all know what needs to happen.
And it's
10-0.
Lose 10-0 to Calgary.
Yep.
Well, the only problem is that they play Calgary after Edmonton. Because then you could lose 10-0 to Calgary and then blow out Edmonton and just like perfectly replicate the beginning of the season.
Right.
But unfortunately, the games happen.
No, but that's okay.
Because
you just need, like, after game 80, you'll have a good sense of whether or not those last two games matter at all.
Mm-hmm.
So then you're comfortable losing 10-0 to Edmonton, to the Flames. Just as a good luck charm. It's like when a knight takes like a piece of cloth from Milady into battle. It's like that.
It's exactly like that. The perfect analogy to sum up this situation.
Hello, Milady. May I have a quilt of your frock?
Did you say a quilt of your frock?
Yeah.
All right. Sure. Holland pavement back there, Dom. Holland pavement.
I'll be honest. I loved Dom's use of the word frock.
I liked the commitment to the voice.
Me too. Yeah.
If you're gonna do a bit, you may as well go all in.
You guys not seen the Family Guy episode where it's like the medieval times?
I have not.
I haven't either.
That's where I got frock.
That's
from.
Where you got frock from.
Yeah. I've seen Cable Guy. It's my favorite
medieval times.
Yeah,
I went to medieval times in Vegas once.
It
was fun.
Yeah,
it was awesome.
Fun.
Actually, it was super fun. I was hoarse from like yelling and screaming and cheering for my dude after the
you have
after
the comically
thing.
Large.
I don't think I ate there. I think I ate dinner before and just drank at medieval times.
I when I was in university in Toronto, right where there was a medieval times right down by the CNE,
mm-hmm.
I'd like jokingly asked a girl out at a bar and was like, "Yeah, like
let's go to
medieval times." She was like, "Great, we exchange numbers, whatever." So I literally like go to
she's
pick
now
her
your
up.
Wife.
No, it's not. Absolutely not. I go to pick her up, and I'm like, yeah, so like we'll go for dinner at medieval times. And she was like, I thought you were kidding. I thought we were going elsewhere. I'm like, no, I bought two tickets. I'm going to go to like a lampshake.
How'd the date go?
Yeah, no, it was a one date.
A one-off?
One date relationship.
Like, oh, he really, she tells that story now. Like, can you believe this guy took me to medieval times on a date?
I'm pretty sure her version of the story includes like the chicken fat was running down his chin. Well, because you're eating the...
Yeah.
Yeah. You're an idiot.
Somebody texts in, Drance the Riz Master.
No chance.
Classic Riz King
Drance
move.
Drance has risen.
Never. That's never been said before.
Okay, we just have a few minutes left here, but I did want to read this one. Hey guys, Donovan from Powell River here. Had a heated debate with my father. If we have to wait until the playoffs to start to dust off the Canucks car flags, or we can put them up now, let me know what you guys think about this. Thanks. Well, first of all, I'm curious who was on which side in the debate, Donovan, between you and your dad here. But, like, they haven't been in the playoffs since 2015. You don't have to wait to start getting excited. They've clinched. They're going. If it was a bubble situation and we didn't know if they were going, I'd be like, well, okay, maybe don't tempt fate. But, like, they're hosting playoff games in a couple weeks. Yeah, get excited. Do whatever you want.
Did you have a take on the clinched T-shirt?
I think that's league mandated, isn't it? Every team
really?
Has a clinched shirt.
No.
Yeah, like, I'm sure Fanatics has a deal with the league where it's like, if your team clinches, you have to have a clinched T-shirt that you sell.
Are you just making that up, or
yes,
did you actually see that somewhere?
No, I didn't. No, it's just common sense would say that, you know, these are things that every team would do.
Not necessarily. Like, teams can make their own, some of their own merchandising decisions,
too. No, I understand that, but, like, just look at baseball, for example. They have, like, 100 different pieces of merch.
Sure.
Football does the same thing.
Sure. I know in baseball, like, if you get, like, your ALDS hat or whatever, right? But I haven't seen it in hockey before.
I don't put anything past Fanatics.
I mean, look,
at this point.
I'm looking at the NHL shop and I see nothing on clinched T-shirts. The only they're selling like playoff shirts, but like the top returns are all Canucks ones. Like
that's
Van
really
Base
sad.
On Instagram.
That's really sad.
Look, I'm not going to begrudge anyone buying merch to celebrate their team making the playoffs, but it probably wouldn't have been a purchase for me. I'll put it that way.
Yeah,
I'll diplomatically put it that way.
But what would be do you wear gear of the team we cover?
No, but I mean, like, even when before I covered the team, I wouldn't have been purchasing it.
There's some sick Canucks starters jackets these days.
There's some awesome Canucks merch.
Yeah.
Canucks merch is actually awesome, and they figured out better ways to shrink the flying skate, which is nice. Very happy to see that graphic shrinking has improved to that point. I was just confused why people were making fun of them.
Really?
Yeah, you know how sometimes I just, like, don't get things that are basic?
Sure.
That was one of them. I was just like, why would you be mad? Like,
well, I get about not being mad. I think the line of criticism was that it was a little like maybe overeager, overzealous.
The bar is like too low,
exactly.
Being set too low.
But like, again, like I'm not going to be
clinched
I'm not
the playoffs
be mad about
in a
it.
Full 82 game season in 10 years.
That's true.
I don't know, man. I just like, if you want to wear a clinched T-shirt, like what if you want to wear it ironically? What if you're a child who wants it?
It's made
no, 100%. I'm not. I'm said. I'm not going to like say anyone shouldn't buy it.
Those are for children.
Yeah,
Dom has weighed in. Those are for children.
Well, think about it. It makes sense.
You're teaching them vocabulary like
clinched. What does
frock. Clinched
mean?
Clinched a frock.
By the way, somebody's texting. Can you even get a car flag anymore? Like a fresh new car flag? You must
Canadian
be able to.
Canadian Tire. Yeah.
Canadian Tire. There you go. There you go. All right, we're gonna wrap it up there. We're talking about Canucks playoffs. Vancouver Giants are in the playoffs right now as we speak. They split the first two games in Everett against the Silvertips. They're back home hosting games 3 and 4 at the Langley Event Center Wednesday and Friday this week. Tickets are available on the Vancouver Giants website. So playoff hockey in Langley for the Vancouver Giants right in this series after splitting the first two games in Everett. For more on the Giants with the Giants Report, here is play-by-play voice Nathan Canter.
The Vancouver Giants accomplished what they needed to on the road to open their best-of-seven series with the Everett Silvertips, a split of the first two games. The six-seeded Giants snatched a 6-4 win in Game 1 this past Friday night, scoring 4 first-period goals, including 3 on the power play, to chase goaltender Tyler Palmer. Cameron Schmidt had a pair on Friday, including one 43 seconds into his first-ever playoff game, while Kyron Gronick and Ty Haliburta also scored their first playoff goals in the victory. Assistant coach Adam Maglio says a big part of the Game 1 win was focusing on the basics in the defensive zone, which was protecting the middle of the ice.
Our compete level was really high, and something we needed to key in on against an Everett team that comes at you pretty hard. I thought for the most part we were composed. I think when things got a little chaotic, we resorted back to the middle of the ice, protecting the house, and obviously Myhrvold was outstanding.
And speaking of Brett Myhrvold, he was simply incredible in Game 2 on Saturday, doing everything possible to keep the Giants in the game. In the end, 2-1 Everett was the final score as they tied the series 1-1, but Merwald finished the evening with a career-high 53 saves. And with the series now knotted one game apiece, things shift to a building where the G-Men were incredibly successful in the second half of the season, the Langley Event Center, where the club went 12-2-1 in 2024. In fact, Vancouver beat Everett at the LEC in the only meeting of the second half. They won 4-3 back on February 3rd, when Sam Honzik had the game-winning goal and Merwald made 34 saves. Maglio says the team can't wait to play in front of their home fans on Wednesday and Friday night.
This year, you know, our home record's been really good. Our guys really feed off our crowds there and the energy they bring. So we're looking forward to that going into game three.
With only 44 shots on goal in the first two games combined, the Giants will look to get more offensive zone time and, more importantly, get to the front of the net. That certainly worked in game one. Game three of the best of seven goes Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Game four is set for this Friday, April 5th at 7 p.m. as well. You can grab your tickets to both games at vancouvergiants.com/tickets. There is also a special group offer for Game 3 on Wednesday only, where you can get a ticket and free drink voucher for just $20 each, taxes in, when booking a group of 20 or more. You can call 604-4GIANTS to learn more about this unique offer. Game 5 is also now guaranteed. That will be played in Everett on Sunday afternoon. 4:05 puck drop there, but for now, the Giants' attention is on Game 3, Wednesday night, 7 o'clock puck drop at the Langley Event Center. For your Giants Report, I'm Nathan Kanchuk.